I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. More than 80 Vermont Air Guard members have started deployments of up to 6 months since October, supporting U.S. missions in Europe, Asia, and Africa. Several hundred Army Guard soldiers are set to deploy in the first quarter of 2021. They're leaving at a time when the U.S. is still dealing with rising coronavirus cases and the initial rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines. Guard members have been aiding in Vermont's response already, assisting with food distribution and setting up field hospitals. The Guard may also be called on to administer the vaccines when doses become more widely available for the general public. Deploying can always put a strain on families, but having a family member leave during a pandemic, when adult work schedules are challenged and children are in some cases still engaged in remote or hybrid schooling, makes this time particularly stressful for some families. The Guard is also still trying to deal with reports of sexual assault and discrimination. Today on the show, we're going to talk about these issues with Vermont's Adjutant General Greg Knight. General Knight, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I'm glad you could join us for the full hour. And I want to encourage Vermonters who have questions for you. This is a great opportunity to be able to ask the head of the Vermont Guard any questions you have. General Knight, let's start by talking about these deployments. Can you describe how many VTANG airmen deployed this fall exactly?
Starting this fall and up through January, we're going to have about 80 airmen, and many of those are already deployed, but this will go through January.
And
as you noted there,
yeah,
in support of the various combatant commands, European Command, Africa Command, and Central Command.
And Central Command, Europe, Africa Command, Africa. U.S. Central Command encompasses the Middle East, a little bit of North Africa, and some of Central Asia, correct?
Yes, we call that Southwest Asia, yes.
Okay. So are these three different missions or more than three different missions, or how are they being divided up among those very large U.S. commands?
Yeah, so they're going in support roles. So this is a non-flying mission for us, and this is part of a regular rotation that happens about every 5 years. And they'll go into those existing units that are already deployed in the respective commands, and they'll pick up those missions. It could be security forces, our logisticians, personnelists, civil engineers, everything there to augment and meet the needs of the commanders that are already in theater.
So are they going in groups, or are they likely to be dispersed pretty individually?
No, they're going in small groups. It's been past a weekend. In fact, I went and went to three different deployment ceremonies, and they were all small groups, some as small as four or five, and some, with a few more.
Just a semantic point here, General Knight, although I said airmen, that is the technical term, but these can be both men and women.
That's correct.
So do you have a sense? I mean, it sounds like they're going in, they're in supporting roles. It's a non-combat mission. This is something that happens every 5 years or so. What are some of the things that they're going to be doing in this deployment?
Well, they're a little bit of everything, obviously aligned with their career fields and their specialties. So we've got folks doing civil engineering. And, for example, those are the folks that helped us design and build up the alternate care facility over in Essex. Their job is to go into an austere environment and help augment civil engineering and build things where currently, in some instances, there isn't anything and make it an operational environment. Security forces, obviously, they do security missions. So all of the missions are tailored to, again, meet the needs of the combatant command, the unit that's in theater, and tailored to do what they do best.
There are also several hundred Army Guard soldiers deploying in 2021. How long has it been since we've had this many Guard members called up for deployment all at the same time?
So, Jane, the last big one for us was a brigade-wide deployment in 2010 to Afghanistan. And this one is different. A lot of folks don't know that the 86th Infantry Brigade Combat Team Mountain Brigade is composed of six different states. So it's Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Colorado. So we have units in each one of those states. What directly impacts Vermont is we'll have about 950 soldiers going out in what we call battalion task forces. So they are built with different capabilities to meet the need of the commander in theater. So it could be infantry combined with combat engineers, any our field artillery, any number of specialties, build that task force. And that deployment, and we differ a little bit from the Air Guard. The Air Guard deployments are about 6 months. The Army's will be about a year.
That's a long time for a lot of service members to be gone from Vermont right now, as I mentioned, particularly in such a challenging time here at home.
It can be a challenge, and we're very attuned to that. And I think Miriam's going to talk to you a little bit here about what we're doing to help mitigate some of the pressures that folks are feeling at home. And certainly in this environment, it certainly gives us a new set of challenges that we have to deal with.
So when that happens, are there guard members who say, I can't do it right now? And are they able to get dispensation for that, depending on what their personal situation is? I know, when you join the guard, you are joining up for a set amount of time and with certain expectations. But, you know, I imagine that this may be a challenging time in a different way for some guard members.
Sure. So early, well, first thing I would tell you is we get a lot of notice that there's a deployment coming, and we spend a great deal of time building what we call a deployment manning document to make sure that our soldiers and our airmen have sufficient lead time and they can plan accordingly. That being said, you're right. There are some things that get in the way and may preclude their ability to deploy, at least deploy right now. So we do hardship boards, and folks can come in, and soldiers and airmen, and they explain why it is they can't go. And when, you know, if we can fill somebody else in their position, we'll do that. We're attuned. The priority for us, obviously, is we need to do mission accomplishment. But we have to do that by remaining attuned to the needs of our members. We ask a lot of them historically and now. Nothing's changed. Operational tempo remains very high. And we're in demand. We're good at what we do. And I think that's a testament to us, but it does present challenges. You're absolutely right.
How many people have requested that kind of a hardship mitigation?
Well, only at this juncture, only a handful, Jane. Less than 10, from what I understand.
And have they been granted?
I don't know. I haven't heard back from the hardship board. We just did one this past drill weekend, so I don't have those numbers in front of me.
We're going to go, though, to our other guest in this segment. Miriam Boyle is the Family Readiness and Program Manager for the Vermont National Guard Family Programs. And I believe, Miriam, I think I hear you. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm
here.
Oh,
wonderful. And we did want to talk to you today about some of the ways that you are supporting families as we see more than 1,000 Vermont Guard members in totality deploying during this really challenging time at home. So I'm glad you're here. Can you talk a little bit about what you do in the National Guard Family Programs to support families and how you might be doing things differently right now?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. So you're absolutely right. With the pandemic, it has gotten quite complicated as far as taking care of our veteran service members and their families. As far as the deployments go, our biggest job, I would say, is to communicate with the families to make sure they're prepared and know exactly what to expect when their service members deploy. They need to know what resources are available to them. They need to know who they can call if they have an issue. And we would normally do these check-ins in person over a yellow ribbon event, one day or a weekend. And just briefly, for those who don't know what a yellow ribbon event is, we basically bring together all the resources that pertain to our families during deployments. That would be like financial, medical, dental, education, legal, those type of things. And we bring them all together. And then we have a pre-deployment, a mid-deployment, and a post-deployment event, because the resources for each stage might be different. So overnight, we went from planning our in-person yellow ribbon events to going completely virtual. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of service members going out the door. So it was critical that we make sure the communication was still at the level that we needed it to be going virtually. And we just had one, actually, a virtual one at the beginning of December that went very well. It was difficult leading up to it to make sure we had everything covered, but the feedback from the family seems to be very positive.
Miriam, you know, when I think about some of the guard families that I know, you know, deployment is always hard, but it's also mm-hmm. something that they expect and they, mm-hmm. in many cases, have dealt with before. But, right. you know, right now it's even more difficult to get help from your fellow community members and friends and families. I mean, we have a governor's order that says we can't engage in multi-household gatherings. And so some of the support networks, while some of it can work online, you know, getting some help with childcare is more difficult right now. Trying to figure out how to navigate the real stresses and mental health strains and physical strains on people during a health pandemic and global pandemic, it's just hard. So, you know, A, what can community members do to support those who they know in their community who have a service member deploying, but also what can the Guard do differently and better to try to support people when they don't have that in-person kind of help that they may usually have?
Right. So one of the good things that for family programs is that we have what we call boots on the ground. We have Vermont Veteran Outreach Specialists as well as the Military and Family Readiness Specialists that are embedded in all of the communities throughout the state. They work and they live in the same communities as our veteran service members and families. So it really is about making those connections maybe one-on-one safely, social distancing, masks, and the whole nine yards. But you're right, it's very difficult to connect with them. And we've had several platforms that we've been able to use for the online. For example, one of the things that we have in the Guard is a soldier family readiness group. Every unit has what we call an FRG. And it's usually volunteers, the spouses, the family members, brothers, sister. And we do a lot of training. And a lot of it takes place online anyway, because we might have a FRG leader down in Westminster or one up in the Northeast Kingdom in Newport. So sometimes it's easier. We're already ready. We've already had it established to be able to do a lot of this online. So we train them because they're the ones that are connecting with our families to, you know, throughout the deployments. So we make sure they have the tools, the phone tree callers, the FRG leaders have the tools they need to communicate effectively with our family and let us know what issues they're having, what challenges.
Well, what are they telling you? What are families telling you about the challenges right now?
Well, there's a few that are what we call first-time deployers. So it's the fear of the unknown. They said, how am I going to run my household without my service member? Who's going to plow my driveway? What if I need to get in touch with my service member? So that's what they're telling us. And we try to, what we're really good at is we're so embedded in all the communities with all the different community partners, everything from the Northeast Kingdom Community Action to Hunger Free Vermont to Agency of Human Services. We're all connected and collaborate with all of those agencies. So we know what the resources are out there to help. You know, if you need someone to plow your driveway, or it never fails when you have a service member who's deployed, that's when your boiler will blow up or you'll have a leak in your basement. It just seems to happen that way. So we try to make sure that we have a list of people that our families can call to help with that.
Any COVID-specific concerns people are sharing with you this time?
Not really, other than, you know, just the isolation and because of the pandemic. I think there's more stress on the spouse or the partner, he or she who is at home, because when you're a service member getting ready to deploy, you might be doing more trainings, you might be away more, your schedule is much more regimented than during a non-deploy time. So it's up to the person who's left home to figure out, okay, are our children going to do remote learning or hybrid learning? What I was working, now I'm not. How am I going to supplement my income, so forth? So we have one of our resources is Military OneSource, who does a great deal with spouses, with education and employment opportunities. So that's the bulk of the issues that the families are expressing in relation to COVID. And we've had some of our service members, like you said, helping with the setup of the field hospitals and providing services medical services to the state. So they call us every once in a while and say, what is my service member doing? When will they be home? So that's something that we can help them with. We can get the answers for them to kind of relieve some of that stress.
And is there a way for community members who are not connected to the Guard to do something helpful? Is there a website they should go to or other ways that they can connect?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So our website is a great way, as well as our 888 number. So our website is NG for National Guard Family .vt for Vermont .gov.
Great. And we'll link to that as well on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Miriam, thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate your insight today.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank
That's
you.
Miriam Boyle, Family Readiness and Program Manager for the Vermont National Guard Family Programs. General Knight, I'm very sorry about the technical difficulties. I'm glad we have you back.
I'm glad to be back, Jane. That wasn't me.
No. It's, seriously, we're going to just have to chalk things up to 2020 at this point because
I'm ready for 2020 to move on.
Yeah, you and me both. What I had asked you before we lost you last time, and then we talked to Miriam Boyle for a little while, is to just talk a little bit about the 86th Infantry Brigade, the Mountain Division, because it's a specialized division within the U.S. Army. And so I'd like to have people understand a little bit more about what it does. And the Mountain Unit played a really big role in combat operations in the Middle East. So describe what it does a little bit.
So it's actually the only Mountain Brigade in the Army inventory. So we've got specialized training with a number of our soldiers in that unit. And they get that through our Army Mountain Warfare School. So it's a specialized decline. It's designed for working in mountainous terrain, all climatic conditions, and that pays some benefits for us, obviously, to our recent deployment to Afghanistan, because that was the nature of the terrain we were working in. But the training, it's very unit-specific. In each one, we have a training cycle over a number of years, and it'll start with individual training. And then that in turn grows to small unit, squads and platoons, and eventually you end up with a large-scale collective training. So if I look at, in my view, is perhaps the best infantry brigade combat team, certainly in the National Guard, we've been asked to go down to the Joint Readiness Training Center, which is basically our Super Bowl. It is the most significant training event we can put a brigade-sized unit through. We've been asked to do that four times in the past 10 years, and I think that's the most of any National Guard brigade across the United States. So that's a testament to them and their excellence in what they do.
And I think it's something around 350 soldiers in this brigade that will be deploying in 2021?
Actually, about 850.
Oh, and that, so, okay.
Yep, and that's it. We also have small units coming from our other colonel-level commands. We've got our public affairs detachment going. Mm-hmm. To support European Command, and then our law enforcement detachment is also going to European Command.
Oh, right. So, yes. Yeah, so, I was separating out the law enforcement. So we're including all of those in the Mountain Division as well, not just in the 86th Infantry.
Yeah, in this totality, we'll have about 950 Vermonters from a couple different units going.
Great. And so, yeah, as you mentioned, some of these are military police officers who will be, I think they're going to be in Europe, right?
That's correct.
And what are they going to be doing?
I would imagine it'll be aligned with peacekeeping operations and security type operations. That's what their specialty is.
Let's go to Laura, who's calling in from Wilder. Hi, Laura. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My name's Laura, and I'm from Wilder. And my son is actually going to be deployed, and this will be his first deployment. Understandably, he's a little nervous about it. And as a parent, my questions are, how are we going to be able to communicate with our soldier? Will they have internet access? We'll be able to FaceTime them, message them? And then in event of emergency, how will we be contacted?
Yeah, Laura, thanks for the questions. General Knight?
Laura, thank you for the question, and thanks for calling in. So deployments have changed drastically since I went in 2005. The connectivity has increased a great deal, and all of our soldiers or airmen that have been deployed in smaller groups or as individuals since then habitually have had internet access, so they can contact you via email, again, depending on bandwidth and how austere the environment is. They can have FaceTime, so the communication piece is in large part resolved. We didn't have that in 2005. So we're going, I would imagine, in some instances, going to, you know, established locations that will have that type of connectivity. But as far as communications, if there's an emergency at home, Laura, you can reach out to us. And your member, if it's coming back to home, if there's an emergency, we would use the Red Cross and get a Red Cross message, depending on the urgency of the situation. But normally, communications is pretty streamlined at this point.
Let me just briefly bring back Miriam Boyle, Family Readiness and Program Manager for the National Guard Family Programs. Miriam, it sounds like Laura isn't very well connected to the programs you were telling us about earlier. So how can Laura get connected to make sure that she's aware of everything that's going on, that she's getting all the messages, and that she can maybe feel supported?
Right, absolutely. So the first thing I would say is she wants to get in touch with the FRG for the unit that her service member is drilling with or going on the deployment with. They will be able to keep them connected. They'll be doing monthly wellness calls and so forth. So she can get that information from her service member, or she can call us at our 888 number and we can get her that information. I also wanted to mention, as General Knight mentioned, the American Red Cross has the emergency notification process. And it's basically, if there is an emergency and a family member needs to get in touch with their service member, they call the 800 number, which I'll give you in just a second. And the Red Cross has the whole network set up so that they will be able to call the command and kind of triage the situation for the family. The emergency services number is 877-272-7337. And that's also on our website, ngfamily.bt.gov.
Thanks, Miriam. Laura, does that help answer your questions?
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for that information. It's really helpful.
Good. And good luck to you and good luck to your son. Thank you very much for calling us. We are talking with Adjutant General Greg Knight, and we're bringing in, as needed, Miriam Boyle, who is continuing to listen with the National Guard family programs. Let's go to Ken. Ken's calling in from Newfane. Hi, Ken. You have a question for General Knight?
Yes, General Knight. I was reading in the New York Times, Maggie Haberman reporting that conversation that Trump had with retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor. And amazingly, in that meeting, they were bandying about the whole question of martial law with respect to the election results that didn't go favorably for Trump. And given your position with the Vermont National Guard, I mean, what do you think about martial law? And, you know, what would happen if you were called upon to impose it? I mean, it just seems like nothing's off the table these days. And so I'm just curious since you're on the show.
Thanks, Ken. General Knight.
Hey, Ken. Thanks for the question. And actually, this came up during a joint committee. So it was House General Housing and Military Affairs and Senate Government Operations. And I actually brought our Judge Advocate General in to talk through some of the specifics of that. But what it boils down to is how we're used. So if it were for, you know, a civil disturbance, our role is pretty straightforward. We're always under civil authority. We work for the governor. The governor is our commander-in-chief, and he delegates the running of the guard to the adjutant general. But our role, our reason for being here is to preserve life, protect property, and maintain public safety. So it's pretty straightforward. It's much more complex, and there's a whole lot between here and there if we talk about an insurrection act where we're actually used to quell an insurrection. We are not there, and I don't envision that we'll get there. That's just my perspective on it. We are always answering to civil authority.
Speaking of your role within the state and answering to the governor, can you talk a little bit about what Guard members have been doing in support of the state's COVID-19 response?
Sure. So we were involved very early on. We're very fortunate to have that type of alignment with the governor, his staff, and our members of the cabinet, and our partner agencies. So currently, we've got about 110 soldiers and airmen supporting response to the pandemic. We've been as high as over 400 Early on, we immediately embedded planners within the State Emergency Operations Center. Those are medical logistics branched officers to help with planning to the response. We stood up the alternate care facility in Essex, and that actually became a best practice. So our civil engineers from the Air Guard, members of our band, soldiers and airmen from other units came in, and they stood that up in a week, and they did that for less than $300,000. And that's with hot and cold running water, nurses' stations, deep sinks, power to every bed. So that I of course, I share that. We're not going to sit on a good idea, but I shared that with the 54, and that in turn went to all 54 or off all the FEMA regions. We're not doing it currently, but in conjunction with the food bank over the course of about 4.5 months, we distributed 3.2 million meals across Vermont, really helping folks who are feeling the pinch of the pandemic. We've taken at this juncture over 30,000 COVID-19 samples at different sites. That's our medical specialists. And I would, if I get a public service announcement in here, Jane, make sure you pre-register if you're going to do that through the Department of Health website, and we can get you tested. Just last week, we went over 100,000 test kits assembled, and that's important because it takes the burden off of the labs so they can actually focus on processing. And then we've been supporting the Strategic National Stockpile Warehouse, and that's receiving, organizing, and then pushing. I think we're over 450,000 items of PPE now. And one of our more recent missions is the COVID, what we call voluntary COVID mapping. Some would call it contact tracing, but it's we've got nearly 40 soldiers and airmen, and that's we're building that capacity, and that keeps us up with the recent spike in cases across Vermont. And you did mention the vaccine support. We're planning for that mission. Right now, the focus is going to be receiving it, organizing it, storing it, and then preparing for distribution. And then you probably saw in the news the cyber support that we did, and that's one of the, unfortunately, one of the best kept secrets in Vermont is our defensive cyber operations element and our 229th cyber operations squadron down in Northfield. And that combined team, they provide expertise, as you saw with the response to UVM Health Network, getting those folks back online. That mission lasted about a month. And the training and expertise they bring, they get that not just through the military, but, you know, they're trained to the industry standard. So that was, you know, great for us. It was fortuitous. They just did a cyber shield exercise, which is a national-level cyber exercise. And one of the exercises they went through was a scenario exactly like what they saw at UVM. So it worked out well for us. But it's pretty important that we've got that depth of experience in the Guard.
When Guard members are participating in these various different initiatives that you talked about, including setting up field hospitals and including what role you expect to play in vaccine distribution and administration, this is all done on a voluntary basis. Is that correct, that Guard members have been asked to volunteer for this service?
That's correct.
Do you anticipate having enough people volunteer, even with the deployments we just talked about, in the next several months?
I think we'll be in good shape, Jane. I actually spoke to Kevin McCallum about that in his article.
The Seven Days Reporter. We can link to that. It's a very interesting article as well. We'll link to it at vpr.org.
Yeah, right now we're in pretty good shape. I don't think we're going to feel too much of a pinch on the backside of deployments because we're going to retain an entire battalion here, our brigade support battalion, as a rear detachment. And a lot of our medics and the folks that retain the expertise that we're looking for, transportation specialist, for instance, all of those folks reside within that battalion.
Have you been pleased with the number of people who volunteered? Have you had to turn anyone down, or you know, has this been a little bit more of a challenge?
No, I think we've done pretty well. First, I would tell you, Jane, I'm really proud of our soldiers and airmen. I mean, they've stepped up. It's not just that they're stepping up to do the job; it's the way they do the job. It's the pride and care for their communities and for Vermonters that they demonstrate at every level. So that's been heartening for me to see that level of response from our folks. And if things did truly get bad enough, we could do an involuntary call-up, but we're not there yet.
Have you advocated for Guard members to be prioritized in the state's vaccine distribution rollout? Because, you know, there are a lot of different organizations still trying to figure out that represent different types of people in different jobs and of different vulnerabilities in figuring out exactly who gets the vaccine when.
Right. So we're going to align our plan with what the governor and the Agency of Health and Human Services comes out with. So obviously our folks that are working in a COVID exposed environment, they're going to be, those are the first responders, the first line workers. they're going to get it first, and then we'll, in essence, triage that down to folks like me who work in an office and who are not always exposed to COVID.
How many members would you say are or should be in that initial response as first responders?
Well, and my hope is we don't stand that alternate care facility up again or don't use it. It's stood up. It's ready to go. But that would be, for instance, if we ended up turning that back on because there's a need, those folks would get it first. But right now I would anticipate we've probably 25 or 30 folks that are continually on mission to do the samples, the COVID sampling. Those would be the first ones to get it.
Let's go to a call. Peter's with us from Barry. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Yes, I want to thank the general and all his members for their service. And also, the question I had was, do you think there will be more active war zones that you will be getting into them in the future? I was wondering, with President Biden, he seems to want to be more involved internationally than maybe President Trump. I guess President Trump has withdrawn troops from different areas. So that was my question.
Yep. Thanks, Peter. General Knight, different change in the top command in the United States. So how does that affect Vermont Guard and what you anticipate deployments to look like under a Biden administration?
Well, I'll tell you, thanks for the question, Peter. And for us, we remain really a vital part of the national defense strategy. And I can't predict what's going to happen. I can tell you we certainly live in a very dynamic global environment. But we're ready, and that's what we do. We train for this. And, again, we will get notification of a deployment to go support different theater commanders, at least a year out, if not longer. So we kind of know what's coming. But we'll adapt if those missions change and we get sent someplace else. We'll be ready for that because the training is aligned, again, with the specialty of the unit, though.
As the Adjutant General, what role do you play in determining the missions that your service members go on? I know that there's this sort of top-down, and you said you'll await different instructions to see what kind of deployments might be coming. But what role do you play in communicating up the chain to say, here's what our service members could be doing, here's what we're prepared for, and, here's what we are doing in our state's response that, might complicate things?
Right. So that it's really a function of how we're built, Jane. So we've got three colonel level commands on the Army National Guard side, and then we have our 158th Fighter Wing. So all of this is based on our training and the niche requirements that are met by any combatant commander or the National Command Authority. It will be a very specific ask. They're going to say we need this type of unit to do this type of mission. And that's it's a national approach. So if Vermont is what we call on the patch chart, meaning that unit patch will end up someplace on a timeline, you've been identified based on your training. And that's something that I think is important for folks to understand. So I'd mentioned earlier going to the Joint Readiness Training Center. That level of collective training has a shelf life. And it's up to the Army and the National Command Authority of how we use that. So, four times we were ready. We didn't get to go anywhere, and that's fine. And now we are. So, again, it's a matter of timing for us. The training is complete, and we're the most ready that we can be.
General Knight, you've said that addressing sexual assault is a priority for you in your role as Adjutant General, but you also told 7 Days earlier this fall that sexual assault numbers haven't changed much since you took command. There have been at least 6 cases of abusive sexual contact reported this far. What's the current number as of now, December 21st?
The number, actually, Jane, is still at 6 for 2020, but I think it's important to note so that the reports that we get, the information is not always current. So if I look from the inception of that reporting program, 33% occurred before 2010. That's when the program started. And then the reports don't always include a National Guard member as the alleged offender. So 46%, for example, 46% of the perpetrators actually were outside the Guard. So in essence, the reports don't equal prevalence. Now, I can test for COVID, but we can't do that for sexual assault. So just because I know of them, that doesn't mean there aren't more out there. And that's really rebuilding trust in our system is important to me. And making sure that survivors and victims of sexual harassment or sexual assault come forward.
So what are you doing to build that trust and to make people who have that either in their past or are currently experiencing sexual assault and discrimination able and comfortable to come forward?
So you had mentioned up front the assessment. Mm-hmm. I think you termed that as an audit. So I want to just make a quick point of correction. It's actually an assessment. An audit would, to me, indicate that somebody external has asked us for it. Actually, I voluntarily asked for it because, honestly, I don't know what I don't know. And I really wanted an outside look of both the Air and Army National Guard, so the Guard as a whole. And that, I think, will give me the perspective I need. If I quote Epictetus, who's a Greek philosopher, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So I can think I know what's wrong, and I can think I know where to focus, but I want to hear that from that assessment team. And if I have a minute, I can walk you through how that works, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with a guard-wide climate survey. And in our case, that took a couple of months. I extended it a couple of times to make sure more folks could have a voice, more of our soldiers and airmen. The feedback I got was that our state far exceeded other states who have had a like assessment done. Those climate surveys—
Wait, exceeded in what way? What do you mean?
A greater percentage of folks participating.
Got it. Thank you.
And then that's followed by individual interviews. And it was great until COVID happened. So instead of doing them in person, I think they had to go to phone calls or email. But in the end, it's a published report, and that comes with findings and recommendations. And that's important to me because those recommendations I view as a handrail to make this a better organization and more inclusive for all. And in the end, I plan to share the findings. This is a publicly releasable document, and that's my plan.
So you're calling it an assessment. I called it an audit. It is something that you called for. It's an outside audit in the sense that it is not being conducted by any member of the Vermont National Guard, but it is a military assessment, correct?
That's correct. So the team is comprised of members from the Office of Complex Investigations, members of the Judge Advocate General Corps from National Guard Bureau, and members from other states. So they have no affiliation with the Vermont Guard.
And you expect that to be completed in January?
Yes, so it should be in legal review this month. It really got derailed by COVID, so I anticipate the last feedback I had from the team is it should come out in January.
And that you'll make all parts of that public?
It depends on what they send me. This is a new one on us. I imagine they're going to give me what I can actually share, and that's the intent.
So, you know, you can wait and see what that assessment says, but there are also things that, you know, you already know now. You do have reports of sexual assault. You do have reports of sexual discrimination. You can look at leadership and your ranks and how many women are part of the Vermont Guard in general. So what are you doing even ahead of the assessment to try to and what do you think needs to be improved in terms of the culture of the Guard?
Mm-hmm. So one of the first things I did, Jane, and I've shared this in different venues before, I shared an expectations of conduct counseling and my command philosophy, and that was to every member of this organization, including me. And it's basically, this is how you're going to treat others. This is how you treat your colleagues, and we're not going to tolerate bystanders who allow this to happen. And what I found in this job is a lot of our challenges are because there was somebody in the chain of command who knew something or saw something and said nothing and did nothing. So that was my initial process to get at that. And we revisited that again this year, and I changed it from reading and acknowledging to actually including you will abide by. To me, it's a tool for commanders and our senior NCOs to address aberrant conduct when they find it. We did establish the provost marshal position, working with the legislature. We anticipate that'll be filled beginning of January. We're doing interviews right now. For me, that provides a liaison with civil law enforcement. They can certainly assist with complex investigations, and that's not something we had internal to the National Guard, and then serve as a compliance team. So when I went through that Fort Hood report, I'm identifying areas that we're actually ahead of it. We're already implementing and making change where the Fort Hood report, a number of units were deficient in areas that led to that tragedy.
You mentioned that you've changed the expectation. Can you point to any specifics that you've seen that would suggest that both the words that you've said and the change in wording have actually led to more people who know something saying something?
I haven't had anybody come forward specifically specifically to me, but I can. There are things that will be transparent to you and to your listening audience. I see things in communications with my subordinate leaders. So I'll give you a little vignette, Jane. I had an email chain that was forwarded to me, and I had three young company commanders. Now, these are our smallest unit commanders engaging in an email conversation about changing culture and addressing specifically those things that you're mentioning, the sexual harassment and sexual assault. And I found it heartening because one of these young captains said, every time I talk to the adjutant general, this is what comes up. These are the things that keep me awake at night. So for me, that's progress. If I've got subordinate leaders, young officers paying attention, that's where the change comes. I can change the climate, Jane. But to me, it's those young subordinate leaders. That's how you change the culture. I had another example of that at one of my brigade support battalion units. I was actually talking to a group of young female soldiers, and I asked them, how's it going? You're working in this environment with a majority male unit. Are you being treated differently? And again, it was heartening for me because I had a young E4, a young specialist, and she told me, we don't put up with that. They don't tolerate sexual harassment. And she said, not only do we not tolerate it, they don't tolerate it as a unit. That, to me, is progress. That's how you change a culture.
What are you doing on the recruiting side? You know, we know recruiting has been a challenge for the U.S. military in general, but certainly as you look to perhaps addressing culture changes that are needed or encouraging more women to join the Guard, that's going to have to be partly a recruiting effort.
Oh, it is absolutely a recruiting effort. And again, one of my major efforts here is changing the communication as an organization. We've done a pretty poor job, from my perspective, for the past couple of decades. We just haven't told our story and communicated effectively kind of across the board. And that's inclusive with the legislature, which is why I asked for the legislative caucus. You know, it gives me a venue, as us as an organization, to share information. But one of the things that the fighter wing did is they established what they call the Priority One Task Force. And that was focused, that's created to focus on recruiting, retention, and increasing diversity and inclusion. In fact, it was so successful that they received the Air National Guard Diversity and Inclusion Team Award for 2020. So that's pretty significant. And it to me shows, again, folks kind of grasping the direction that we want to go, and they're taking it there.
Would you describe the military as hyper-masculine, and should it be?
I think there are elements where, like if you're an infantryman, there may be elements of that, Jane. I don't think somebody puts on a uniform and becomes hyper-masculine. I think we're made up of a cross-section of society, and you bring to the military your background, everything that you've learned to get to that point in your life. My job, again, is to change the climate and help folks develop professionally so they find a balance in how we treat others.
What would you be able to point to if you and I are speaking a year or 3 years from now that would look and feel different? I mean, it's hard to assess culture and say this is what's different. So what are you hoping to be able to tell us in a couple of years?
Well, I can tell you there's progress now, Jane. If I look at the wing again as an example, and I don't have enough time to tell you about the challenges I have on the Army side, that could be another call, but 50% of the wing first sergeants are women. These are senior NCOs, leading airmen. 50% of the group chiefs are women. That's a colonel level command. 45.5% of new lieutenants are women. 27% of my new enlistments into the fighter wing are women. What that tells me is that really is shaping the future of opportunities for women in the Air National Guard. The Army's different. We haven't been built that way for a long time. It only changed about 4 years ago. But even then, we may be the first state to open a battalion-sized unit to the recruitment of women into combat arms. So that'll be a first for the nation.
Good. When do you think that would be?
I hope to hear that. Well, the request is down at National Guard Bureau. That's the mechanism. We have to ask for permission after we have the right leaders in place, women leaders at the unit level, and when we accomplish the training required. It's a request to National Guard Bureau. So we hope to have that word fairly soon. It's been down there for about a month now. So we're looking forward to that.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about that as well. Brigadier General Gregory Knight is Adjutant General of the Vermont National Guard. General Knight, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks so much, Jane. Happy holidays and all the best in the new year.
Happy holidays to you as well.